It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Last Thursday marked the one-year anniversary of the public release of ChatGPT, an AI chatbot created by the technology company OpenAI. It's gotten a lot of use since then, and it sparked big-name companies, Google, Amazon, Facebook, and others, to kick their comparable programs into high gear. The popularization of ChatGPT kicked off huge changes, good and bad, for many industries beyond technology. Our next guest has been keeping a close eye on ChatGPT over the last year and looking ahead to where it might take us next. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried out ChatGPT or one of these other types of generative AI? Has it been helpful for you? Has it changed how you do your job? Are you worried or excited about the future of these kind of systems? Or do you have questions? A lot of people do. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Robin Zabrowski is an AI theorist and professor of cognitive science at Beloit College. Robin, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Robin, for those who haven't been following the story or those like me who follow it but don't necessarily completely get what's going on, remind us what ChatGPT is and what generative AI means.
Sure. So ChatGPT, the GPT stands for Generative Pre-trained Transformer. And the idea is that this is a chatbot, basically, that's trained on absolutely astounding amount of human text. So it learns the rules of grammar, and it also learns sort of little pockets of what context it needs to respond to questions and things like that as a human would. But it does so all through abstract kind of, it's just math. It's not actually learning what the words mean. It's not learning how to actually think like a human does. It's really just sort of parroting back things that it's remixed from its training data.
Why did the release of this chat seem to sweep through the industry like wildfire? New York Times did kind of a timeline of the release. It seems like OpenAI didn't think it was that big a deal. They're going to put out an earlier version of their work. And then it was all over and all their competitors were moving up their timelines. Why was it such a big deal?
So we've had chatbots that are trained kind of like this for a really long time. The technology itself isn't really terribly new. But with ChatGPT, because they had the resources to train it on so much more text than we traditionally had, and also the fact that more data about us as humans exists to be training data, right? Surveillance capitalism sucks up everything we do online. So there was such a bigger training set that it appeared way more successful at what it does than most of our other chatbots. They had released, or at least I knew some people that had access to GPT-3, I think, which is before, I think ChatGPT was 3.5. Mm. So they had kind of released it. And it, I mean, I had been hearing from people that it was kind of impressive and they thought it was doing interesting stuff. But you're absolutely right that when ChatGPT was released, suddenly everyone wanted to play with it. It wasn't just this weird little niche thing for experts.
What are people doing with it so far? Playing with it was the start, I think, but it seems like a lot of businesses are saying, hey, we need to evaluate how this works, figure out what to do with it before our competitors do.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's being used for a lot of things it shouldn't be used for. It's being used to like write copy for companies that need marketing materials. It's being used in so many different ways. One of the worst things I think about it is that it's being used to replace humans, but very shortly, companies are realizing that it's not doing a good job of that, right? Like I know Sports Illustrated just got in a lot of trouble. They released some articles that they claimed were written by real people, and a group of researchers discovered that the people themselves were computer generated. And so Sports Illustrated had to look into the company they outsourced to write these things, and they still swear it was written by people. It seems really unlikely. They're not the first magazine or media outlet to use ChatGPT to write to write articles. They're just the latest to get caught, I think.
Talking to Robin Zabrowski from Beloit College. Robin studies cognitive science there and artificial intelligence programs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how these things work, what all the fuss is about? Have you tried ChatGPT or one of its competitors on your own for school, for work? Tell us how it worked at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You gave that example of a news article or sports articles, as the case may be, written by chatbots potentially. You're also concerned about, and a lot of people are concerned about, deep fakes, generated images that we're seeing coming from conflicts like that between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. What are some of your worries there about invented images, invented maybe video even?
Yeah, I think we're in a really bad place as far as that's concerned. Not only do we know for a fact they're happening, it wasn't Getty Images, but I think it was Adobe Stock who recently, and they even label them generative AI, but they label it with very, very tiny word, like little tiny letters. But they are just hosting a lot of fake images of the Israel-Hamas conflict. And it is outrageous that there are people who see those and believe that they are real, when in fact what's going on is just as terrible. You don't need fake images. But it's also really problematic because it erodes public trust in those institutions that we really rely on. So journalism is just in a lot of trouble with this, because of course the media companies want to not pay photographers and writers. But in doing so, when we see actual real images like of the war, it even those of us who trust journalists have a hard time trusting that the media we're seeing is real. And so there are people doubting certain things about the war itself because the fake images are proliferating.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Walker is with us in northern Wisconsin. Walker, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I wanted to tell you that I'm a single man. I was trying to that young lady, cute picture, nice conversation, very articulate, and kind of caught a couple of little red flags, and so I ran a few test questions, and she doesn't exist. She's AI.
Interesting. Walker, thanks for the call. Now, Robin, I know that there are scams online and by phone where people, sometimes against their will, are impersonating another identity. There is a concern now that AI may be used to do that sort of thing in what are often called a romance scams, like it sounds like Walker may have encountered. How big a concern is that people who generate a lot of scams will have their power multiplied to create these things?
Yeah, I think it's a big concern. These sorts of things, again, have been happening for a while, but because the tools are so much more readily available now, there's much more possibility for them to get into the hands of bad actors. Things like the deep fakes where the voice can be replicated. I know there was already a high profile case, and I totally forget which company it was, but it happened probably within the last 6 to 12 months, where someone had a conversation with a high level executive on the phone, and it turned out the entire thing was not actually their executive. So the voice was spoofed really, really well. I think it's really bad. And I think the fact that people in AI have been warning that these sorts of things were coming for a really long time, it's kind of embarrassing that there's not a single country that had any kind of regulation in the books. And we still don't, really. I think that until we get some sort of regulations about some of this technology, it's going to just get worse before it gets better.
Thanks for sharing that experience, Walker, at 800-642-1234. Again, at least according to this New York Times timeline, some of the big companies, the Googles and others who are working on these programs, were playing it a little slow, trying to tackle problems of, you know, are these chat programs putting out bad information? How could they be misused? And then because OpenAI released their product, a lot of them started to throw that stuff away and just try to do it fast without worrying about the potential for harm? How surprising was it that they were slugged out in the first place? How worried are you that they, if that was happening, they stopped doing that?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. I think that OpenAI really shocked people, in part because most of these sorts of chatbots were only really very interesting to people who already worked in the field. So when ChatGPT was released and embraced so widely, I think that scared, again, all of those other companies. And I mean, it's really interesting that there are only a few companies that are in serious competition here, right? You named them. It's like Microsoft, Google, Meta, and OpenAI are really like, it's it, because they're the ones that have enough money to have been able to train these things. And so, yeah, the ones that were playing it a little slower really got scared into throwing their own models out there in the world. And we saw what a disaster that was in certain cases. We saw, what was it? I think Bing and Bard ended up like co-evolving a bunch of disinformation among themselves, right? We are able to see the problems because they released all of this stuff to the public way too quickly. And I mean, I think that's probably part of why all of these problems exist, is because the hunt for money is really outweighing the need for caution.
We're talking to Robin Zabrowski, AI theorist and professor of cognitive science at Beloit College, about what's happened in the year since ChatGPT was introduced in the world, followed by other generative AI chatbot programs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think your job could be changed or replaced with something like ChatGPT or its competitors? Do you think it's ethical to use AI to write, make art, or do other creative activities? How about what these programs do with information they've gotten from us in the first place? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Robin Zabrowski, AI theorist and professor of cognitive science at Beloit College. We're talking about ChatGPT, how it's impacted our lives in the years since it was released, where this kind of technology could be going next. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you used ChatGPT or a similar program just to see what the big deal was, or maybe in your job? If you are a teacher or professor at some level, are you seeing your students use it? How are you dealing with that? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Go back to your call. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hey, Jeff.
Well, speaking for myself, I'm very optimistic with this technology. I think it's just a step toward the day when we can see holograms or 3D computer-generated animation. I was at Disney a few years ago, and I talked to Abraham Lincoln. I thought that was pretty cool. But why couldn't we have family members, like at a gravesite? You could sit and talk to them. I mean, this is the potential to be very creative and positive, in my opinion.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. And there are some things like this, I can't remember where, but programs where you talk to a historical figure, the creators kind of put in boundaries where you ask, you know, if you ask Harriet Tubman what she thinks of laser technology, she'll say, that's beyond, you know, what I knew in my time, or something like that. The potential for educational opportunities with this sort of thing, Robin, what do you think?
I know they seem really fun, but they kind of worry me as well, especially if you're thinking about talking to a historical figure, right? There might not be a whole lot of training data of their speech in particular. And so, of course, the underlying system, before it's trained specifically on like Abraham Lincoln's speech or something, it's got to be trained well enough to do the very basic chatbot stuff. And we know for a fact that all of the training data that's been used for all of the current popular systems was just deeply, deeply infected with racism and sexism and basically all kinds of awfulness. We know in part because right after OpenAI released their model a year ago, a news story also broke that they were paying contract workers in, I think, Kenya, $2 an hour to deal with all of the harmful, awful stuff to try and weed it out of the system. But it's like baked right into the underlying model. And so it worries me to think that we're going to be using that like skeleton system to try and have kids talk to Abraham Lincoln. Like I'm still very nervous about what's in those models.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. Justin joins us now in Menominee. Justin, hi.
Hey, thanks for having me. Yeah, I just wanted to note, I'm a writing professor at a university here. And so part of our approach to AI, for not for everyone, but part of our philosophy is to sort of introduce students to Gen AI to sort of help them see sort of the guidelines of where to use it and where not to use it. We don't want, you know, the technology to take over the thinking part, but there are some useful things, you know, proofreading, editing, and other kinds of sort of invention type strategies that could be used.
Yeah. What kind of assignments do you give students to have them, I guess, partner up with Gen AI, but not rely on it for the content?
Well, so I see in the news, there's different fields and STEM fields that are excited about AI applications in helping to crunch, you know, large bodies of literature. And I don't think we have quite access to that yet, but I like students to sort of see that. So I ask them to read, you know, difficult articles and summarize them on their own. But after they have a set of maybe five summaries that they've done, sometimes it's helpful to ask Gen AI, what kind of patterns are you seeing here? What kind of future research needs to be done? So I think it can be used not to overtake our thinking necessarily, but as another tool to help us sort of see patterns maybe and see what kind of research could be done next.
Interesting. Justin, thanks for the call. Robin, what do you think?
Yeah, I think introducing students to how the systems like this work is a really good idea. I think that educating not just students, but literally everyone on exactly what these systems do and how they do it is really important. There are concerns beyond students using it, for example. Like, yes, lots of people call them overconfident plagiarism machines because they're not generating anything new. They're just taking all of the data that they've been trained on and sort of remixing it. And they do so very, very confidently. So in some ways, you have to be really careful what kinds of information you accept as factual that are coming out of them. But I also think there are a whole host of other concerns that should give us pause about whether or not we engage with these systems really at all. People are finally starting to acknowledge the radical environmental impact that these systems have. We know that the training of them consumed something like as much water as a Western state uses in a month or something. And we know that for every 5 minutes you spend talking to ChatGPT, it's like the equivalent of a bottle of water getting used to cool the servers. And we also just know that there are other really, really enormous environmental impacts. And so the question is, are the use cases of where this is possibly a helpful system, does it really outweigh the underlying poisoned training data and the environmental impact and the distrust and misinformation that it's sowing in the world? So the question is sort of just like, why do we need this? Couldn't we use a much more specific model to teach our students about looking for patterns in their writing, for example?
Thanks for that call, Justin. Bonnie is with us in Lake Geneva. Bonnie, hello.
Hi. I feel very strongly that ChatGPT is contributing a lot. I think back to when Wikipedia came out, and everybody was so taboo. You can't use Wikipedia. It's just written by people. Well, people, that's democratization of information. So I use ChatGPT a lot. I'm a teacher. For example, recently I assigned a video to watch. Then I cut and pasted the transcript, asked ChatGPT to write 10 open-ended questions about that transcript. I also assign it to my students. They were recently we finished up electromagnetic energy. And so I wanted them to do a report on a specific light and color, and to, you know, tell a lot about it. They use ChatGPT to get that information. Is your color trademark? Is it a rare pigment? What is the exact wavelength? So ChatGPT provides a wealth of information, and I don't think we should be scared of it.
Bonnie, thanks for the call. The factual information issue you mentioned, Robin, the unreliable plagiarist, people, including I think some of the creators of the chatbots, are saying it isn't a search engine, at least not yet. Your concerns about relying on it for factual info.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I know that, like, if you log in to use ChatGPT, in the tiniest, like, 4-point font at the very bottom, it says that it's not necessarily factual and you should double check your information. But it's like they could not make that any smaller. But there's zero reason to believe basically anything that ChatGPT says. They've been doing a better job of fine-tuning the system since they released it. But when they first released it, and I'm pretty sure this is still true, although they've made it a little harder to do the sorts of tests we all were doing. If as an academic, I asked ChatGPT back about a year ago, like, can you tell me some papers that Robin Zabrowski has written about AI? And it spit out a very confident list of 10 papers that don't exist. Not a single one of them had a title I have written. There were journals that don't even exist. Some of them were journals that were very excellent. And I was like, wow, I'm glad that it thinks this highly of me. but there's no reason to believe that the information it's giving you is correct. It's literally giving you answers around word frequency in its training data. So if you think about how much of the internet isn't factual, like it is trained on Reddit. And there's lots of subreddits that I am not super interested in repeating and that I don't think are sharing factual information about the world. So, yeah, especially if you're using it and trusting the responses it gives you, it is absolutely still inventing sources, giving answers that are just flatly incorrect. I would be very, very cautious in deploying it in that kind of educational context.
Thanks for that call. And Robin, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Robin Zabrowski, AI theorist, professor of cognitive science at Beloit College. She was with us to review the year since ChatGPT's release, how it's changed business, our lives in some ways, how the technology's developed, and where it might be headed. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Several Wisconsin labor unions filed a new lawsuit last week challenging Act 10, the 2011 law that ended almost all collective bargaining for most public employees. The law has been unsuccessfully challenged in court multiple times since it was enacted. The latest lawsuit makes a different legal argument and could make its way to a state Supreme Court that now has a 4-3 liberal majority. We're exploring what makes this lawsuit different from previous state court challenges to Act 10 and the dynamics with the current makeup of the state's highest court. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this latest Act 10 lawsuit? Do you think the outcome will be different this time? Should be different this time? What questions do you have? Do you think Justice Janet Protasiewicz should recuse herself from the case based on past comments? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Howard Schwaber is a professor of political science emeritus and affiliate faculty at the law school at UW-Madison. Howard, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right. A lot of public employees in Wisconsin are familiar with Act 10. People who are around for the hullabaloo remember it. Can you remind us, though, what the law changed?
Well, Act 10 essentially abolished collective bargaining for public employees, and the biggest target by far was the teachers' union, except as to very, very limited matters involving salary up to a certain point. Depending on who you ask, the reason was to save the state's budgetary resources and make school districts better able to allocate their resources, so they were able to pay some teachers less, for example, if they weren't performing well, and reward teachers who might be more junior but were good teachers, and so to generally increase flexibility. On the other side, people who opposed Act 10 said it was a targeted effort to weaken public sector unions, which had been strongly supportive of Democratic candidates, and of course, a fair number of observers thought it did both.
Now, some public employee unions were exempted in the public safety field, thinking mainly police and firefighting unions. And that, Howard, is, as I understand it, is at the heart of this constitutional challenge in Wisconsin courts. What is this lawsuit arguing?
That's exactly right. So the lawsuit is brought under the Equal Protection Clause of the Wisconsin Constitution. And I should note right off the bat that in 1999, the Wisconsin Supreme Court said that the Wisconsin Equal Protection Clause works exactly the same as the federal constitutional Equal Protection Clause. So everything people know about equal protection law applies here as well. And the claim is there was no good reason, no legitimate reason connected to the purpose of the bill for singling out public safety employees to exempt them from the operation of this disqualification from collective bargaining. Now, there's a couple of pieces to that argument. One is the claim that since the purpose of the bill was allegedly to save money and conserve budgetary resources, only motivations having to do with conserving money and conserving budgetary resources could legitimately justify treating one group of employees differently from another. The second part of the argument is that in general, there's no good reason, no legitimate or rational basis for treating these public safety employees differently than we treat, say, teachers. So those are two sides of the same argument, which is that people are being treated differently for no good reason. And that fundamentally is the equal protection claim that's being made here.
Now, the counter argument there has been some of these public safety officers have different pension plans and things like that. They are compensated differently, different retirement benefits based on the nature of their work. So since we've treated them in contract terms differently than other public employees, that gives a precedent to do it with Act 10. Do you see that as being a likely counter argument in the courts?
Well, that by itself, I don't think is a particularly strong argument because, of course, the response is, well, maybe that was unconstitutional as well. That is, you can't really establish the constitutionality of a practice by saying, well, we did it before, because it's equally easy to say that that prior act was also unconstitutional. But here we have to get a little bit into the weeds of mm-hmm. this thing. In an equal protection claim, it makes a big difference what kind of people are being treated differently or on what basis. So I'm sure all our listeners remember the recent case about race-based affirmative action in college admissions at the U.S. Supreme Court that got an enormous amount of press. The reason that case was argued the way it was is because when the government wants to treat people differently based on their race, it almost never is able to satisfy the required justification. There's almost never a good enough reason to justify treating people differently on the basis of their race, their religion, their nationality. And that's what's called that. Those kinds of classifications trigger what is called strict scrutiny. And the short version of that is it's sometimes called strict in theory, fatal in fact. Basically, it's extraordinarily difficult to justify treating people differently on those sorts of bases, and the government almost never can do so. That's not what we have here, though. Here, the idea is that people are being treated differently depending on the nature of their employment, and that one group of employees who are in public safety areas are being treated differently from those who are called general employees. That kind of classification only triggers what's called rational basis. It's the lowest level of scrutiny. And again, to put that in practical terms, if the government has any legitimate reason or can come up with any legitimate reason for treating people differently, that's all they have to do. And so here I would think that the government's stronger argument would be something like, look, we recognize that Act 10 was controversial. We recognize that this loss of collective bargaining might cause disruption. We can tolerate that kind of disruption in some areas, but not where public safety employees are involved. And that's our rational basis for keeping them happier. And that would be, as near as I can tell, a perfectly sufficient constitutional justification for the way the law is structured.
Now, there have been a lot of lawsuits related to Act 10. As I understand it, Howard, and please correct me if I'm wrong, this specific equal protection argument hasn't made its way to Wisconsin Supreme Court yet. But there have been federal cases under equal protection. Obviously, Act 10 is still in place, so those fizzled somewhere in the court system. If this argument didn't work in the federal courts, is there a reason to believe it should prevail in state courts?
Well, that's exactly right. Precisely this argument, or a variation, and it was brought to the Seventh Circuit, which is the federal court of appeals, and the Seventh Circuit said, no, the Wisconsin law, Act 10, is perfectly constitutional, essentially for the reasons I just described. There are a couple of reasons why you might think the Wisconsin court might rule differently. First, you might think that the Wisconsin Constitution's Equal Protection Clause works differently than the U.S. Constitution's Equal Protection Clause that the Seventh Circuit was talking about. But that's why right at the beginning I made the point that they're not, that the Wisconsin court, at least in the past, has said they work the same. So that's not a good argument unless you can persuade the Wisconsin Supreme Court to change that. The second reason is sort of pure politics. There's now a liberal majority. And so if you think that courts are purely outcome-driven partisans and the judges are you know, partisans seeking policy advantage, then maybe these justices won't like Act 10 and will find a reason to strike it down. Those are, you know, those are the gambles that the people challenging the law are making. And I have to say, I don't think that they will succeed. I find it hard to imagine that the Wisconsin Supreme Court will either abandon the idea that equal protection under the Wisconsin Constitution works the same way as it does under the federal constitution, or be willing to apply that test. Now, they're not bound by the Seventh Circuit, but I find it hard to believe they'd be willing to apply that test in a way that would have so many repercussions for other potential future lawsuits and do so much to disrupt the way equal protection law is understood in Wisconsin.
Talking to Howard Schwaber, professor of political science emeritus, affiliate faculty at the law school at UW-Madison, looking at the latest legal challenge in a long series of legal challenges to Act 10, the state law restricting almost all collective bargaining for most public employees. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Howard, I want to follow up on that. You know, we focused a lot on the legal side of things. The cynical view is what you just described there. We have conservative justices and liberal justices, or in effect, Republican justices and Democratic justices in this cynical view. None of that legal stuff matters in that argument. They're going to vote the way their partisan sympathies lie. Is that too cynical to think that way?
I think it is. Now, I'm the first to say, and I've said so publicly many times, that Wisconsin Supreme Court elections have become hyper-partisan, hyper-politicized affairs and have strayed far away from Wisconsin, what was once the Wisconsin tradition of a nonpartisan judiciary. But this is going further. Let me be neither naive nor purely cynical. Even if one thinks it's true that the justices want to reach outcomes they approve of on partisan or policy grounds, I don't think they'd be willing to disrupt too much of the existing legal framework to get there. And in this case, you really would have to abandon or apply in a very, very different way a very broad chunk of Wisconsin equal protection law in order to strike down Act 10. And I just don't see these justices being willing to do that, no matter how much they might personally think Act 10 was a bad idea.
Now, this isn't at the state Supreme Court yet. This was in a Dane County Circuit Court to start things off. I mean, do you see it as likely it's going to end up at the state Supreme Court? I guess I've been assuming it will, because everything does. Is that necessarily the case, though?
Oh, absolutely. sometimes these things are unclear. This one's really obvious. No matter who wins or loses at the district court, the other side will appeal. And whoever wins or loses there, the other side will appeal again. So I'm absolutely certain this will come to Wisconsin State Supreme Court. It will take time, however. It's likely to be months or a year or so before the state Supreme Court hears this case. And of course, there could be further developments before then. But yes, this question is a core question of Wisconsin constitutional doctrine. It's a pure legal question, so nothing that's decided at the district court level can really prevent, you know, the issue being raised at a higher court. So yeah, absolutely, I think this is going to be at the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
Let's bring on a caller. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hey.
Hello, gentlemen. So my question is would it be constitutional to treat different employees differently because of their political persuasion? So if the teachers union and the county workers who got the shaft are vote Democrat, but the cops and the firefighters who supported Scotty Walker and his crew, is it legal, do you think constitutional, for you to say, you know what, you guys support me, so I'm going to leave you alone. You guys don't, so I'm going to give you the shaft.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. That political argument has been made, Howard, that this was punishing a perceived political rival and not punishing sympathetic public union employees. Will that matter? Could it matter in a court argument?
Oh, it absolutely could. That is, so first of all, yes, that would be unconstitutional and illegal, no question about it. And that was the argument that was brought before. It was a First Amendment challenge saying that certain classes of employees were being punished for their expressions of political viewpoints through their unions. The problem is that when we're dealing with an equal protection challenge at this low rational basis level of review, you would have to prove that that was actually the intention. It's obviously the case that it's sort of interesting coincidence that the unions who are most notably anti-Scott Walker ended up losing their collective bargaining abilities. And it's not at all surprising that many people jumped to the conclusion, which may even be true, that it was political retaliation or an attempt to strengthen the Republican hold on the legislature. But from a legal perspective, one would have to demonstrate that. The government can come back and say, no, we had this alternative reason you haven't considered, which is by itself rational and legitimate. And as long as that's true, as long as that alternative basis exists, unless you can affirmatively prove that it was a pretext, that it really was specifically, subjectively intended as political punishment, the fact that there's an alternative legitimate explanation defeats the legal argument. And that's the situation that we're in here now. If Scott Walker had given a speech saying, boy, I'm sure going to stick it to Democratic leaning unions, and that's why I'm promoting this law, we would be in a very different conversation. If you want a comparison, the lawsuit that's being brought against Governor DeSantis by Disney is an example where arguably a governor really did come out and say, I'm doing this to punish a political opponent. And sure enough, in that lawsuit, the First Amendment claim seems very strong. Here, we don't really have that.
Jimmy, thanks for that call. We're talking to UW-Madison political science professor emeritus Howard Schwaber about the newest lawsuit challenging Act 10 in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the equal protection arguments we've been hearing about in this lawsuit? Do you think this is a valid argument to overturn Act 10? What do you think the courts will do, should do? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Howard Schwaber, political science professor emeritus, affiliate law school faculty at UW-Madison, with us today to look at the legal arguments in the latest lawsuit looking to overturn Act 10 in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Act 10 has been a positive for Wisconsin or a negative? Either way, what do you think of this legal challenge, this new legal challenge to it? Do you want to see it succeed or not? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions. That's 800-642-1234. Howard, another issue here, the newest justice, Janet Protasiewicz, seen as being on the liberal side of things, had told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel earlier this year that she would consider recusing herself from cases involving Act 10. Here's a listen.
You know, I'd have to think about it. I was interviewed by the New York Times, and they said, what do you think? Do you think that Act 10 was unconstitutional? And I said, yeah, I agree with the dissent in that case. You know, the dissent, I think Ann Walsh Bradley authored the dissent in that case. And I said, I do agree with the dissent in that case. Given the fact that I marched, given the fact that I signed the recall petition, would I recuse myself? Maybe, but I don't know for sure.
Okay, Howard, what should sway that maybe one way or the other in considering recusal?
Right, so it's worth pointing out that Brian Hagedorn was involved in giving legal advice to the legislature when this law was being drafted. So if there's a recusal argument here, it could apply to more than one justice. Really, this comes down to sort of the law versus, or the ethics versus the politics of it. On the law and ethics side, there's no need that I can see for Protasiewicz to recuse herself. She has expressed a legal opinion about a legal issue, and in that sense, you know, maybe said to have prejudged the question before, but it was on a lawsuit that was on a different legal theory. She has not expressed anything, as far as I know, on the specific equal protection argument that's being brought right now. And more generally, recusal is most appropriate where a judge or a justice has a personal interest in one of the parties, a financial interest, for example, or a personal relationship. You know, and in the past, we had a situation of conservative justices in Wisconsin not recusing themselves in cases involving questioning the legality of contributions to their own campaigns. So, you know, this whole recusal thing is a bit of a partisan hypocrisy on the legal side. Politically, however, Protasiewicz might want to think about recusing, particularly if she is able to canvass her fellow justices and determines that her vote wouldn't make any difference on the outcome. I'm obviously speculating wildly now, but looking down the road, by the time this thing does reach the state Supreme Court, if Justice Protasiewicz determines that there's enough of a majority one way or the other, that this case, that her vote won't change the case, it may be politically a wise thing to do just to demonstrate her impartiality. I fear that I've actually, in the interest of being simplifying, left out what might be the most important argument. So let me mention it very quickly. One argument that's being made is that even if there's a good basis for treating public safety employees different from general employees, the way this law works is dishonest because some public safety employees are treated differently than other public safety employees. So for example, Wisconsin State Police are exempt from Act 10, but Capitol Police and University of Wisconsin Police are not. Now, I would think there could be a rational basis of the sort that I described earlier for saying that a disruption in the operations of the state police is more dangerous to the state than a disruption in the operations of the Capitol Police or the University Police. But that might be, of all the elements of the complaint as I read it, that struck me as the strongest one because that becomes the argument, see, this really is a pretext. You don't really care about singling out public safety groups. You're really going after unions who don't support you. And if you want to show that kind of pretext, one way to do that is to show inconsistency in the application of the definition. So if there's a basis on which the Supreme Court might strike down Act 10, I think that would likely be it.
On the recusal issue, Chris and Dolivan called in a little while ago, couldn't stay on the line. Talking about pressure on Protasiewicz to recuse from any Act 10 case based on her previous comments. Chris says, so what? We elected her knowing what she said. Why should she recuse? He says, I don't get it. So does, I guess, a judge being judged by the voters erase comments that we might say would be prejudicial in a case she might hear in the future?
Right, that's exactly right. I mean, so if you have a lawsuit between, you know, Mr. Smith and Mrs. Jones, and the judge as a candidate said, boy, that Mrs. Jones is a terrible person, I would certainly rule in favor of Mr. Smith. That's a problem. That's indicating preference for a party. But of course we ask judges and judicial candidates their opinions on legal questions and constitutional issues, and we want them to tell them what they think. The alternative has become, right, the kind of charade we see in nominations to the Supreme Court, where justices insist, oh, they've never considered, you know, whether there's a right to abortion or other constitutional questions. There are a couple of justices who arguably committed perjury who are sitting on the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court right now, on questions of that type. So, of course, it ought not to be disqualifying simply to have said, I feel X about a legal issue or a constitutional principle. This case comes a little closer in the sense that Act 10 applies to certain parties, these unions, and is a highly partisan issue. And Protasiewicz didn't just express an opinion. She also participated in protests and signed recall petitions. So, you know, perhaps there's more here. But I think the caller, Chris, is exactly right that this idea that you can push for recusal of a justice anytime they have a known philosophical position on a legal issue is just wrongheaded. And frankly, it's a created standard that's been manufactured this year.
In just our last half a minute or so, Howard, what, especially if there's something we haven't talked about, what are you watching for as this thing makes its way through the courts? Again, just in our last half minute.
Sure. So there are five or six different ways of framing the issue in the complaint. Which ones of them survive? And what is the more specific focus that this case will have by the time it gets to the Wisconsin Supreme Court?
Howard, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Howard Schwaber, professor of political science emeritus and affiliate faculty at the law school at the UW-Madison. He was with us today for a look at the latest lawsuit over Act 10 in Wisconsin, how it compares to previous attempts to overturn the law. If you have more questions about how this works, the procedure, we'd love to tackle them or share them with our news team. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. You can follow reporting on this case. There's already been a lot. You can find it at WPR.org and then follow along as the case proceeds through the state court system. Again, find all of that at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, if you are confused by modern tipping culture, when to tip, who to tip, how much to tip, you are definitely not alone. get some advice over the etiquette of tipping in the modern age, and sometimes when the cash register asks you itself instead of expecting you to know what to do. And you can share your tipping do's and don'ts as a customer or a service provider. Join the conversation. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. This week marks a milestone in communication history with a great development, or a terrible development, depending on how you feel about text messages. As reported at history.com, on December 3rd, 1992, the first SMS text message was sent. That stands for Short Message Service. It became the standard for cell phone texting for years until it was outpaced by messaging apps. The first text message was sent by a 22-year-old engineer doing work for the company Vodafone in the UK. A few weeks early, it read, Merry Christmas. There's just one problem with this breakthrough in texting technology. Nobody had phones that could text yet. That had to wait for another year until the first text-worthy cell phones hit the market. The newfangled texting concept seems to have caught on over the 30 years since then. This is Central Time.